distinguished looking fathers around there. I have a 9-year-old daughter and a 7-year-old son and a 5.5-month-old son. So, when I get away to a conference like this, I think maybe there's something to be said for celibacy. I kind of enjoy getting away. The meals are a lot quieter. But there's something to be said for marriage, too, which I won't share with you this evening so much. But take my word for it. The Christian Preaching Conference, to my mind, is the most exciting preaching group that there is. More exciting than any of the Protestant groups I've attended. The journal, I think, is the best preaching journal that there is. If you've looked at the others, you know what I mean. So I'm excited about being a part of this group. Tonight we're going to have a series of experiences. I don't lecture. I gave up lecturing quite a while ago, mainly because of feedback. So instead, I conduct experiences, or moderate events, or whatever you want to call it. The first experience that we're going to have is to develop a sermon together. I discovered in what little experience I've had in dealing with people who have read my book, that one of the things that hits them is the fact that perhaps there is more than one way of doing a sermon. The way of doing a sermon or homily, I realize there's a distinction in the minds of many between sermon and homily, but when I speak of sermon, I'm thinking of my own background. The usual way, I suppose, of doing a sermon is to start with biblical material and then decide on the implications for the contemporary situation. I prefer to turn that around. And so the way that we're going to build a sermon tonight is to turn that around and to see what happens. We're going to build a sermon together. And first of all, we need to find out what is the situation, or what is the problem that we're to deal with. And so I'd like for you to think for a few moments about perhaps a situation that you're facing, or one that a friend of yours is facing, or someone in the parish, you know, some problem or problem situation that you would like to share with us, and we'll see if we can use this in a sermon. So think about this, and then when you have one that you'd like to share, one of the gentlemen here will put a mic in front of your face, and we'll start that way. Is there anybody who has a particular problem or situation they would like to share that we can begin with? It's any kind of situation, really, something significant, hopefully. Yes, sir?
When Christ came to give the good news, did he come to give us a moral code or a code of faith?
Let me ask you this. Is there a particular living situation that you're thinking of where this has come up?
I believe that with our young people today that they have rejected completely the idea, in a kind of a general way, of law and authority and so on, but they still have not grasped the idea of faith. In other words, because they reject the idea of a code of discipline and so on, they also reject the idea that Christ came to give anything.
Okay, the situation is that you feel that many young people today reject a kind of a code or law, that they don't hold to this. Would you care to perhaps state a particular situation where this came up, where you discovered this? You know, it came home to you, said, they're rejecting a code.
Well, I deal with young people every weekend, and this is one of the first things that they always say. Get rid of the establishment, all structure is out. Anything that smacks, you get up and you say, we don't want you to smoke in the dormitory because we got too many beds up there and you might burn down the house, and immediately you turn them off this way, you know.
Uh-huh.
So any kind of idea of any restriction immediately focuses the attention on the fact of authority and so on.
Okay, very good. Does anybody have a similar experience, perhaps a specific experience you might mention along these lines, the same category that you'd like to talk about?
A lot of high school boys and girls who, when you speak to them, when you speak about sex, they don't consider premarital sex with me as anything bad. You know, they take it to weak people. I'm horrified. I've heard that specifically quite a few times.
All right, a situation where kids don't seem to be thrown by the idea of premarital sex. Okay, this would be a reaction against moral law and any other instances.
The young people nowadays say that unless a worship form has an emotional and a feeling dimension in their lives, that this kind of thing should not be binding, should have no binding force upon it, like the obligation in this particular case among Catholics for the Sunday Mass.
But you could have gone into detail a little more on that. Name a specific situation, perhaps, where this occurred for you.
Well, I have been for 24 years the chaplain of a large high school.
That'll do it, all right, yeah.
And on a once-a-month basis. And parents pay to go to the specific private high school about $300 to $400 a year. My estimation is that of these so-called 1,000 kids, last year it was 60, this year it's up as high as 70% intermittently have rejected Sunday Mass attendance.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you. Yes, they're in the back. Oh, pardon me, we have a gentleman here.
So many people are willing to tolerate the church as an institutionally racist society and not be particularly excited about the situation.
Okay, that's another issue then, isn't it?
Yeah.
You're suggesting maybe this is something we should
do. Yeah, I didn't particularly care for the tone of the issues.
I detected a certain amount of hostility from this couple of areas here. Yes. I think we should deal with the hostility in the present group. And we could sort of divide along age lines or something of that sort, perhaps. I think perhaps, at least by majority vote of some sort here, I think perhaps, though in some sense the other one interests me personally more, I think it might be better to stick with the morality thing and with the reaction that many of you feel the youth have against various laws and codes. Yes, Dave?
To add another dimension to that one, then, we've seen with the change of the liturgy and the reaction of middle-aged people and older against this, just exactly what so many of the youth are saying. That as a matter of fact, my religion does all entirely depend upon a certain given structure, and as soon as you change the structure, I've lost God.
Okay, then what we've come up with is generally a feeling about the youth generation and about the reactions that they have to liturgy, to moral code, to sexual ethics, and so forth. Let me now move on. I realize there are other hands, but I said I cut you off. Let me move on here, and Father, what's your...
Father Wallace.
Wallace. Would you, since you started this thing, would you express to us your feelings about this issue? I have a feeling you wouldn't have too much trouble expressing this. Why don't you, how do you feel about it? How do you feel about the problem you brought up?
Well, I feel that in the sense that we have so dictated the lives of people and put them into a kind of an idea that everything means just law. In other words, I'm going to get to heaven because I keep a specific law and forget the real issue of life. As I said, the good news that Christ came to preach was a matter of what? Faith, huh? A matter of belief in him. Sure.
Do you feel this personal reaction against laws and codes? So, I mean, you feel it personally?
I do, yes.
Mm-hmm. When do you feel it particularly?
Well, when it pinches my foot, just like anything else.
What foot has it pinched recently? you can stop if you don't want to share. That's all right.
Well, I feel that in a matter of I'm a religious, I'm a Franciscan, and I think in some instances that we have been, like everybody else, designated good Franciscans if we kept the law, or we didn't keep the law, then we were bad. And it wasn't a matter of what law it was; it was a matter of whose interpretation of the law, and and who emphasized what law. So if I had a superior who wanted me to be in at 10 o'clock, well, if I was in at 1 minute to 10 every day, well, then I was a good Franciscan, and I could spend thousands of dollars as long as I was in at 1 minute to 10, see?
Go, man, yeah. Okay.
So I feel that this is a reaction. So I wasn't condemning the young people, but what my problem is, and I think their problem, because I deal with them, is the fact that do we still continue to do this, you know, this emphasis on these laws, and because we have done this in the past, we're never going to have a real communication with these young people. But how are we going to get to them to show them that there is a need for some type of structure, there is a need for some kind of an authority, some kind of a law? How are we going to specifically bring this to them in a sensible, honest way, without too much emphasis on one particular law? Say, Father brought up, one father back there, I don't know who it was, brought up the idea of sex. All right, now, I think I've been on the mission band for 12 years and the retreat band and so on for 12 years, and I think I heard it myself when I was a youngster, and I heard it as a priest. I preached it myself, I think, when I first got on the band. There was no sin like adultery. There was no sin like fornication. I mean, you could go and shoot your neighbor, but don't commit fornication with him or her, see, or something.
Is that right? I didn't know I was written down. Okay. Now, let's go to the hard part. As you look at the biblical material or the traditions of the church, wherever you look for guidance, as you look at these, at this material and this history, what kind of perspective can you shed? What kind of perspective can you give? What kind of light can you shed on this situation? Who would like to venture out into this territory for a moment? Yes.
I think you could begin by agreeing with the young people and pointing out the you have heard it said passages, and show that while he has done away with the things, you know, that in the past, he has now brought about a new Christian morality, which in its own way sets us free and makes us human.
What's the new Christian morality he's brought about?
Well, you know, he said kind of sex, how he had to do is look at them or something. No, there are, let me think of the exact words. You have heard it said that this was a sin, or you may not do that, or the classic passage from St. Luke about giving to, you know, if a man, if you can't lend to a man whom you think will return it to you, then how are you better than a pagan, all this kind of thing. So that he is laying down principles and guiding points in very much of what he says. It's not just a type of total, free, do-it-yourself, for me attitude. The whole idea of Christ for others as the person totally unselfish and giving. I think that passage and the passage of the Beatitudes would fit this situation.
I see. Okay. Thank you. Yes, sister. Depends on who you're rebutting, I suppose.
The teenager will say that the commandments do not forbid premarital intercourse, but adultery. And
from what perspective from Scripture would you shed on the situations that have been brought forward?
And that the people who propose situation ethics and the new morality say that fornication is really, in its etymology, misuse of the body, and they have a different interpretation from the traditional one.
Okay. Any more insights which would deal with this this situation? Biblical or historical insights? The second part of your sermon, yes?
My experience with this is that basically for the youth it's a problem of growing up. Psychological problem. Psychologists tell us that basically as a child, dependent upon his parents. Now, during adolescence, he realized he can't be dependent all his life. so he wants to be independent. But somehow during his teenage years, he has to learn he can't be independent either. He can't be dependent, he can't be independent. And then he has to learn to be interdependent. So I think when we deal with the young people, we're dealing with a problem that they are trying to work out through their whole teenage years, and we can't give them a package solution to this.
Okay. Does anybody else want to respond to it? Yes, Francis.
It just as impresses me. I don't know whether it seems that way to you, but we're talking about other people's problems, and every time you try to bring us back, well, how do you feel about it? We go skirting around, and we get back to, well, we got to bring them up so they're mature. Well, do I feel free? Well, let's get off that subject. Let's go, how can we make them feel free? And do you have the same feeling? We're skirting the real issues and our own problems. Are we free?
Any other reactions in terms of perhaps shedding some perspective or light on this problem? Yes, Jim?
If I can share it, I've got a feeling. I get the feeling.
Be my guest.
Not the kids that need the service, it's the people here who are asking the questions. That's just coming out of the gut.
With whom are you identifying on that?
I don't know. But as far as order, ethical, code, and so on, I think that young people, at least the ones that I've been associated with, are very much concerned with building an ethics that will work. They aren't concerned with simply having one imposed, whether from biblical material or somewhere else, and saying, this is the way to live, now live that way. They want to know why. And if you don't have a good reason why, they're simply going to say, well, look at the world that we're in. Your ethical system hasn't worked very well, so why should I pay any attention?
You know, replace a code with a code.
Unless you can, you know, if you could give me a reason, like if the premarital sex is a problem for some people, right, you have to come up with a reason why it's better to refrain than to engage in this particular activity. And if you don't have a reason, well, you can't just say, well, it's naughty.
Yeah. Cut this, please. Let me ask you this question now. This way of developing a sermon, though, of course, it wouldn't usually be done in this big group, but this method of starting with the situation and moving then to how you feel about the situation and then moving to perspective on the situation, both from biblical material, we used also personal experience here. How does this strike you as a way of developing a sermon? Let's get some feedback on this. Anybody? Yes, sir.
Special sessions on national preaching, this was just exactly one of the topics that was brought up and discussed, that in the rectories, in the different communities, what a wonderful thing would be if all the priests could gather together once or twice during the course of the week and kick around the topic that is to be preached on during the course of this next week or perhaps for the next 2 weeks or for the next 4 weeks, and thereby mutually share in the feelings, in the experiences, so that when a priest does get up, he will be expressing not his own personal, isolated opinion, but perhaps the cross-section opinion of two, three, or four other men.
That sounds great. Yeah. Any other reactions to this? Yes. Right.
About 2 weeks ago, I conducted or helped lead a retreat for 17th men to be ordained to the priesthood coming up in May, and we chose special readings every day for our liturgies, and they were really wonderful liturgies, but we drew the scripture readings from our discussions, and they kind of flowed naturally from what we had been discussing during the day, and it was extremely meaningful, and I found to be one of the finest set of liturgies we've ever had. So the type of thing we're doing here, I think, would be extremely valuable. On the other hand, I've also found that with our setup as it is now, that if, I found that when I take the scriptures and go to chapel for about 2 or 3 hours and pray over it, and really try to get some meaning out of it for myself in terms of how it affects me deeply as a person, that I'm able to preach with real conviction in the seminary, that has great effect too. So.
Question passed in that case, what have the people been through? Part of the problem sometimes, isn't it, that the preacher has been building up to this situation, has been through some wrestling with the scripture perhaps, he comes with this kind of a conclusion to the people who haven't been doing the same thing. And sometimes there's a danger, I think, in starting where you are rather than where they are. Now let's go on to, the time's getting away from me, let's go on to something else. I want to do a brief monologue now. You don't have to listen to yourselves for a while. This monologue is based on identification with laity, and the position that I've been in over the years has been more as a layman, though ordained, but more in the lay role, really, than in the pastoral. And so what I want to present now is an identification with laymen. I'm in this, not altogether, but it's also a sharing of some interests and concerns of people I know. I'm speaking to you. I don't live in your world. You live in a world of religion. And I don't live in that world. I think that's that may be a good world. I'm not knocking that world. It's a very interesting world. And when I come into the sanctuary on a Sunday morning, I like to enter that world. I like to know that that world's still there. And I think of you as being a part of that world. I think of you as being one of the religious people, part of the religious world. I'm not knocking that world, but it isn't the world I live in. I have a feeling that when you talk, the language you use suggests that you live in this religious world. The kind of concerns you have, you speak of morality, you speak of what the church wants and the church needs. You speak of a lot of things in a language that I only hear when I come into the sanctuary. I'm not knocking that world, that the religious world that you live in. I think in many ways it's a good world. As a matter of fact, it would be nice if one of my sons, let's say, became a priest. I think this would be good. I think maybe this would be wonderful. But it's a different world than the one I live in. And I like to know it's still there. And when I come on Sunday, I like to know that it's there. I like to kind of sense it. I like it. It seems a little more secure that that world is still there. But when I see you walking around, I tend to think of you as sort of a representative of that world and someone who, in a sense, carries the sanctuary with him. I don't know if you feel that way, but this is the way I tend to look at you. See, the world I live in is a little different from that. The world I live in, I have to kind of watch it. I have to make it as much as I can. There's a guy who is above me, and there's a guy who's below me, and I don't want to go back. You know, I want to go forward. When he moves up, I want to move up and take his place. In order to do that, I have to play it pretty careful. You suggest a lot of things I should discuss, but at my job, I don't discuss those things. I can think about them individually, but I don't deal with them in that situation because, you see, it's very important to me that I be able to maintain my position and to move a little higher if I can. It's important for a whole lot of reasons. You see, I have four children. And, you know, we live in a rather nice neighborhood. I was hoping the house would only cost $25,000, but it turned out it cost $32,500. In order to keep that house going, in order to make the payments of $240 a month, I have to maintain my job, and I have to keep my job. I have some strong ideas about a lot of things. For example, there was an election not long ago in my hometown. And in the election, a black man was running for mayor. I personally thought he was a great guy. I thought that he had a lot to say, and I thought it would be very interesting if he became mayor. And I voted for him. And I sent some money to him anonymously. But, you know, I didn't wear a pin. And I didn't have a sign put up on my lawn because, you see, the neighbors wouldn't go for that too much. And it's important to me to be accepted by my neighbors. After all, my kids don't have the same beliefs I do, and, you know, they could get it with the kids in the neighborhood. My neighbors care what I think, or at least they care that I don't express things too loudly. We have to keep the salary up because we need two cars. My wife doesn't work, but she still needs a car because I'm away a great deal. This is kind of my world, and it's a little whole different world than the world you live in, I think. In fact, I'm sure it is. And like I said, I'm not knocking your world. I think it's an interesting place, and it's a very nice place, and I'm sure that it means a lot to you. And I'm sure that there's a lot of excitement about this. I sense this. You know, I sense that you're in many ways a very joyous people. You get a lot of fun out of life. That's great. And like I said, maybe my son will become a priest, and he'll be very nice. Maybe he'll live in that world. And I go in the sanctuary, and I think that, you know, maybe heaven's going to be like this, and maybe this is a foretaste of that, which would be good. I'd like more security. I'd like to kind of be let off the hook, and I like to not have to go through the pressures and the sort of thing I do every day. And so I'm not knocking that world at all. But it's not my world. It's yours. Now, I would like to have you react to this, and I'd like to have you react not to me personally. That would be interesting, but I'm going to react later to what I said. I'd like to have you react to each other just for a few moments. Turn to the person next to you and just kind of, you know, give your reaction and listen to what he or she has to say just for a few moments, okay? This is the kind of thing you can react to a good deal longer than this. I hope, at least. I hope you didn't just stop after 30 seconds. I was checking out with my friend here as a Lutheran to see if this was, you know, if I wasn't the only one to share this. And he said, no, it's, you know, it's pretty common. I hoped I wasn't caricaturing. I was a little worried about that, but I read enough of myself into it, so that maybe it wasn't that. Next thing I want to do is in a sense, a somewhat different sort of thing. And that is that I'm going to ask, well, I've already asked, I'm not going to spring on them right at the moment. I've asked one of the men here to deliver a short homily. And then what reason he's doing this is in order that we may deal with it critically, deal with him and with the homily. And the reason for doing that is to illustrate some things about criticism, about the kind of questions perhaps that we might ask ourselves and ask of others when we react to sermons. And so I'm asking Father John Ganey of St. Paul's College in Washington, D.C. to give us a homily, and then we will proceed from there. Father.
You may not know Eleanor Rigby. She could easily be a character in fiction, except for the fact that she is so real and in so many people. She's the hero or anti-heroine of a song by the Beatles. And in that song, she is depicted in many ways. She's a woman staring out on the street in front of her after having spent the morning with her glass jar putting on her face. She looks out a window at an empty street. And when she dies, there's nobody at the funeral except Father McKenzie. Father McKenzie throws a few drops of soil on top of her casket, and he goes back to doing the things he does best, darning his socks, making up the sermons that nobody hears. And through all of this singing, the refrain keeps on coming back. All the lonely people, where do they all come from? Most of us here tonight do not put on faces from jars. But we have other faces. There's the laugh-a-minute clown here somewhere. He never quite comes up to facing himself. There's a joke before you ever get to the real person. And I suppose one of us, at least, is the type who doesn't express himself in public. You just don't do those things. You don't let people know how you really feel. us are looking out on the window and on the, through the window on the street of life. And we're doing the same thing that Father McKenzie was doing, except we don't darn our socks. And we're asking ourselves, am I really a lonely person? Is what I am doing really worthwhile? And I think we really must face what we are and what we're doing, or we are Eleanor Rigby's ourselves. Lonely people. And what is a lonely person? The other night at Dulles Airport, I was going up a flight of stairs, somebody else was coming down, asking about the trip that this other person had been on. He says, did you feel lonely out there? The girl said, yes, I did. He says, see that? He says, we're a mess, but we care. He said, there were thousands of people where you were, but none of them cared. We cared. And for us not to be lonely, we need to be cared for and to care. And we're cared for because Jesus Christ decided that we would be. In his resurrection, Christ was saving each one of us. He was saying to each one of us in this room, you're lovable. Not because you're you, but because I took the time to love you. And while he was alive on earth, he took the time to say, I am the way, the truth, and the life. Follow me. Christ gave us the vision not to be lonely people, but to realize that we are cared for and capable of caring. And if we lose the vision, we lose the vision that Christ gave to us, then we are lonely people. People who, when we are buried, will be forgotten. People who, in a sense, find their faces in a jar. But we are not this. We are men committed by vocation to Jesus Christ and to his vision. Called by Christ to preach his word, to share his love with others, and thus to create a community. We may be alone, but we never need be lonely. We need never be either Father McKenzie. And if we are open to Christ and to his word, then we can take what we are, even when we are alone, and reach out to those who are the Eleanor Rigbys, those who are lonely and looking for Christ. Whether we will do that or not remains the question each must ask himself.
I may be permitted a Baptist reaction. Amen. The first question I want to ask you to react to may be, strike you as an odd one, but I think rather important. It's a question we often ask in lay criticism groups that many here are involved in developing lay criticism groups for preachers. It's this question. First, though, I need to know how many of you here don't know John? You don't know him personally? All right, then, well, that's... you need more parentheses. That was dirty. I'm sorry. We have two more days, right? Okay, then I need someone who does not know him personally to answer this. Just on the basis of this sermon, how would you describe his personality? Go ahead, anybody who doesn't know.
Warm.
Sensitive.
Caring.
Caring. personal experience. You didn't feel he was just sort of making a point. Okay. Yes, sir?
Real.
Real, okay. Can't go much better than that, right? Yes, sir?
No two intents in having you, as a preacher, understand what he's trying to
do. Too intense, you think? Okay. How did this come through, particularly?
Well, it's just that he wants you very much to feel the way he feels about it.
Uh-huh.
But he brings an almost a worry that you're not going to understand what he's trying to do.
Uh-huh. Okay. I know some heads nodding back here to that one. Would you care to expand on it? A couple sisters back here were nodding their heads. Maybe that's a trade of sisters, I don't know. I get away with anything in this group. Yeah. Go ahead, sister.
I hate to do this, but...
Go ahead.
I work with college students, and I identify with them, and they would turn this off.
Did you turn it off?
I told you I identify with them.
All right, why? May I ask, what was it that...
Polished.
Applause
were too perfect.
Uh-huh. Okay.
It was
fun. All right. Any more reactions? Yeah, so when we start getting critical, now we get the hands. Beautiful. John, you know, I mean, he said he was willing to do this, so go ahead.
I'd like to point out that
you're
talking to this group.
Right. Uh-huh. But why is that important to you that he was talking to this group? Would you care to expand on that a little bit?
Well, I think it's crucial to know your audience and make an attempt to speak to that audience.
Uh-huh.
But I do feel he could have been a little more relaxed. He, I think he made me, in terms of the intensity thing, I think he was very natural and conversational, but I think he created the feeling of loneliness, which, at least in me, that was kind of stay with me all the way through. I didn't feel at the end the tremendous... confidence that that Christ would take my loneliness away that he was trying to get. I just the mood that he created.
Right.
I don't know if I'm, I might be the only one that felt that way.
Well, you're expressing your view. I mean, I think you find in any kind of a situation where you have a number of people criticizing that they tend to express opposite views, but because what you're saying is in how it struck you, how you felt about it, it's all right to say that, and then whether you don't necessarily have to take a poll and see if everyone else agrees with you. Okay, some hands over. Yes, sir.
I felt that he started off with loneliness, and then immediately he gave the pat answer. Christ had the pat answer. I thought he was going to switch this to the loneliness of Christ and let his answer grow out of a very natural situation that he would create with Christ. Christ experiencing loneliness. And I agree with Sister. I think they turn it off because it's too pat. It's too bookish of an answer. You get to that certain point, you say, oh, here comes the answer again. I think it's better to accept the human experience and to deal with the human experience as a human experience and let the human experience of Christ come through in loneliness, and out of the human experience of Christ would come the answer that you don't have to hang it out on a shingle too quickly, but let the audience more or less sense this and take it themselves, you know.
Okay, let me ask another kind of question here. I'm cutting off again, but let me ask another kind of question. That is, if you were to state what was the major thing in the sermon that was said to you, not necessarily what he conceived of as the major thing, because we don't in a sense know that, I guess, but what was the major thing that he said to you? This often is an interesting thing to discover. Anybody care to contribute on this? Let's get somebody who hasn't maybe said something here. Yes.
You don't have to be lonely because Christ cares about you.
Okay, that's the major thing for you, all right? Does anybody have any suggestion as to something different as the major thing? Yes.
Asking me, will I reach out to lonely people?
Okay. That's what it was said to you. The same thing. Okay. Anybody have something different that they felt was the major thing that was said to them, or to you, rather? Okay, let me ask you another question then. Do you feel that, and this has come out a couple times, but we're going to get more reactions on this, do you feel that he was preaching this sermon to this group? Was this, in a sense, a localized sermon, shall we say? Was it preached to this body of people? You might want to react to this other than just yes or no. I'd like a little more response than that, but yeah.
Well, first, I felt that he wasn't.
At first, it seemed this was a canned sermon, and that it was taken from another situation. But toward the end of the sermon, I did realize suddenly he was speaking to us as people. And consequently, I did tend to react against Sister Dorothy, saying that this would have turned off a college. to sell stuff. And I didn't find it turned me off, but why it didn't is because I'm a member of this group.
If he was talking to us, why didn't he talk about Father McKenzie? I feel, when I first heard that song, old Father McKenzie sitting up in his room, just darning his socks, preparing his sermon, something that, I think there's something of that in our own lives. And if he'd gone a little deeper, and our own feeling of loneliness from time to time, and wondering what we're doing, he would have had me more than try to persuade me of something like Eleanor Rigby putting on a face. I don't feel like Eleanor Rigby putting on a face, and he had to persuade me I was like her. But I know I'm like Father McKenzie. And loneliness is a feeling, and I think he copped out on the real question. When I feel lonely, is it enough for me to say I have faith that Christ cares for me? You know, perhaps that's the answer, that Christ does care. But if I have a feeling of loneliness, to cure that feeling or whatever it is, it's not enough just to say, well, he cares for me. I still feel lonely. Somehow there has to be an experience of Christ caring, and I'd like to know how Father got that experience. If he, you said he felt lonely from time to time, well, how did he get out of his problem of loneliness in reality, aside from giving us kind of abstract principle?
Okay. Yeah.
My reaction is very much the same. I think of the young kid who said, don't tell me God cares, tell me you care. And I was waiting for that. I think we know that God cares and that Christ has died for us and all that. We know that even when we're desperately lonely. And having reminded you, I might get me madder than anything else. I think you have to show me you care.
Let me ask you another question. How did he use the theological material? What do you think of the way he employed this toward the latter part? What would be your comments on this? Yes.
It seemed to me it was very good as far as it went. I kept wondering if he was going to do something with the notion of Christian community. The church is the body of Christ, where if one member suffers, all suffer. One rejoices, others rejoice with it. It seemed to be an opportunity here.
You thought the emphasis on Christian community was missing, or at least wasn't expounded enough. Okay. Good. Yes. Yes, sir.
This is my reaction, that it sounded quite fundamentalist, that I have to accept Jesus Christ as my personal Savior if I do this. But where do we find Christ today? It's in this community of Christians. This is where we lose our loneliness by losing ourselves in the community.
So you felt a similar concern that the community part was particularly, I see, okay, yeah.
I felt that the theological material was kind of forced in, that the same sermon, the same talk has been given with the same message using the same song and not brought in anything explicitly Christian, and could have been done just as well. And I thought that the theological points were kind of imposed on it or forced in it.
Okay. This is a problem all of us have, one way or another. Yes, Bill?
I thought that particular point, although all the positive things that were said about his job, I would feel. I felt about that point that we were moving into a kind of a manual, what I would call a manualese or jargonist, the textbook application point. And I felt that this kind of said for me a feeling I had up until that point, to some degree, of impersonal, kind of removed and indirect. The moment of greatest communication, I thought, really happened to that other kid on the escalator, to whom it was said very directly and very personally, I care. And I really wanted Jesus to say to me through the prophet, I wanted him to say, not in an indirect discourse, now believe that Jesus cares and that he has saved you. But I wanted him to say, or at least to give me the real experience, Jesus says to you, I care.
Okay. Let's go on to another point here briefly. What was communicated here is another way of asking about speech technique in a way, but what was being communicated here non-verbally? Some of this has come out, but, you know, in the manner and the approach and the feeling and so forth, what was communicated to you in this man? Yes?
I thought he was somewhat aware of a rather formidable audience. I think this came out especially in the area that they were just covering, where the theological application was made. I think he was very, very conscious of us, wondering whether or not we were accepting.
Okay, that came through to you. Yes, sir.
This is one area where I have disagreed with Sister back here. I think his very intensity
his presence
yeah.
struck the people.
Struck you, you mean?
Struck me.
Okay.
And drew my attention to what he was saying, what he was trying to say. And the way he used his hands, the way he just looked
uh-huh.
at people and made some sort of physical contact, if you want, by standing up there and being so dynamic.
Right, okay. That's very interesting. Anything else would communicate to you non-verbally we're talking about here now in terms of his manner and so forth? Yes, sir.
I was aware of his intensity, but I didn't interpret it that way. I interpreted relative to the audience as being formidable. And I thought he wasn't relaxed with himself. I didn't feel that he was feeling all that he was saying. I thought he was too intent about saying.
All right. Let me ask you a question now in terms of speech technique here. I generally get to that last, usually when I deal with criticism. I don't know why that is, but... how about the voice? What came through here in the voice? Or what suggestions would you make to Father in terms of using his voice or his manner, gestures, and so forth? Any suggestions that you'd like to make, either pro or con? Yeah.
Well, I would be a little more conversational.
More conversational.
I think it was a little it was very effective, but it was a little affected. I think it was more conversational and relaxed.
Okay.
Alright.
Yes, sister.
That's one reason I didn't think you were talking in this group. These are your colleagues, then you could be more conversational.
Should be more conversational with colleagues.
Wherever they are.
Or wherever they are. Okay, go ahead. Alright, now there's one final thing I want to do, which is in the nature of a monologue. And what I want to do, essentially, is to give a reaction based on identification with preacher in me and the preachers who are here. To the other monologue on You Don't Live in My World, you know, and I want to give a reaction to that, maybe partly because so I don't let myself off the hook, but I just feel, you know, I want to give a reaction to this, so this is it. This kind of thing bothers me a great deal. If I were accused of living in a world that is different from the world in which the laity live, I would feel that this is, if I have communicated this, I would feel this is something for which I need to be forgiven. Because I live in the same world, you know. There's only one world, and I live there too. And if somehow I've communicated the idea that I live in a religious world that's separate from the world that everybody lives in, then I need forgiveness. Maybe it's because I haven't been able to express this. Maybe I've been too wrapped up in religious language, or I've somehow divorced myself from people, and I've somehow communicated to them that I live in a different place. But I don't. I have the same fears, the same agony, the same problems, basically. They take a little different form than somebody, but they're basically the same problems. And why is it? I often ask myself, why is it that I'm often afraid to express this to a group of laymen? Is it because I'm worried about my image, you know, or something like that? But I hope that's not it. Because unless I can express the fact that I am identified, unless I can express the fact that I share the same humanity that everyone else shares, then what I'm preaching is not incarnational, nor is it really even Christian. I'm struck by Helmut Thielicke's words. Helmut Thielicke is a preacher and a theologian, preaches to a congregation in Hamburg, Germany. In one of Thielicke's sermons, he uses the phrase, wounds must heal wounds. Wounds must heal wounds. Unless I communicate to people who are wounded, which includes everyone, that I also am wounded, unless I communicate to them that I know what it is to be wounded, and I felt wounds too, unless I do that, then I can never be of any healing value to other people. As a matter of fact, this is the incarnation, isn't it? That Jesus, you know, was wounded for our transgressions, bruised for our iniquities. By his stripes we are healed. Wounds heal wounds. Because you don't heal wounds by standing up here and looking down and saying, Jesus, too bad you're wounded. Or communicating that non-verbally. Somehow, if I have communicated this, if I have communicated to people that I'm above it, I've overcome it, I'm on top of it, I've succeeded, I'm not preaching Christ. Because Christ actually identified with humanity, right? And this is incarnation, isn't it? This is Christianity. In fact, I have no use really for a Christ who doesn't identify with me. It'd be a harsh thing to say, but I think it's true. But unless God is really here, you know, unless he really, in a sense, was wounded, I don't feel he knows my wounds. Unless he's agonized, I don't feel he knows my agony. And so I need to communicate to people I've agonized too. And I know it is. I'm struck also by a phrase from D.T. Niles, who is a Greek Christian from Ceylon, active in the ecumenical movement, who said that his definition of evangelism was that it's one beggar telling another beggar where to get food. One beggar telling another beggar where to get food. Doesn't mean I have the food. It means I can just tell another beggar where to get it. Point to Christ. Point to God. Not say, I am he. If I live in a world of religion, I'm miserable. Because it's not the real world. If I don't live in that world, really, I live in the same world everybody else lives in. Unless I admit it, I'm not going to be of much help to anyone else. At the risk of sounding as if I'm trying to sell something, I'm still going to read something from you from the end of my book here, where I try to, it's expressed better than I could do it, but. That isn't quite accurate. Nor all I say is someone said somewhere. But anyway, this is what I feel as a way of saying it. It seems to me that the basic temptation that man faces is the temptation to deny his humanity and become godlike. Religion is often used to help bring this about. Many believe that the goal of religion is to make people into godlike beings. But I believe that man must accept his status as man and should receive his humanity as his greatest gift. To me, this means that we human beings should resist the temptation to work for eternal security, infinite knowledge, success, identification with an image that is not who we are, and freedom from anxiety, failure, and death. When we strive to do something that will set us up for eternity, whether it be commitment to Christ or religiously oriented self-flagellation, we are trying to be gods and not men. When we want to know precisely what is right and wrong, what we should do with our lives, and what we should think and feel, we are trying to be gods and not men. When we work doggedly for success in all realms, as if success were possible and we could know when we were succeeding, we are striving to be like God. When we worship an image and try to mold ourselves according to this image, whether it is an image given to us by our society or our religion, we are worshiping a graven image and we are striving to be gods and not men. When we expect to achieve freedom from the pains of living and the fact of dying, we are trying to be serene and immortal like gods in the heaven, but not like men on earth. We need to affirm our humanity with its mortality, bondage, inadequacies, pain, and joy. Let God be God. Let men be men. May we combine our weeping over our lack of divinity with our rejoicing over our gift of humanity. Thank God we are human. Being God would be more than any of us could bear.